Shank Baggily. Shank Baggily. Shank Baggily. Hello and welcome to Shatbaggily, an old Lincolnshire adjective to describe absolutely anything loose and disorderly, which sums up both the podcast and this Lincolnshire lass quite nicely, as I do tend to go off on a tangent every so often. In a moment we'll chat Christmas plants and find out who is Fiona, also the secret of a good Yorkshire pudding, and we'll meet an actress, singer and writer with news of a rather special project. First though, with it being episode 28, here are a few other things with the same number. Meters length of the longest stalactite in the world, found in the Gruta do Janeiro in Brazil. Something like that. So 92 feet, free hanging. Good grief, bet that's a sight to see. And going back to geography days, mites go up and tights go down. The age of the oldest sheep ever recorded. In fact, she was just 1 week off being 29 when she died in 1989. She was a crossbreed sheep from Aberystwyth in Wales and managed to lamb all throughout her life, including her last year, which I find just incredible. And centimetres leg span of the largest spider in the world. Ugh. Gosh, it just makes you shiver, doesn't it? It's the male Goliath bird-eating spider, or its posh name, Theraphosa blondi, found in Venezuela in April 1965. I'd have a thrombi, me. It says here that its span, equivalent to 11 inches, was sufficient enough to cover a dinner plate. Oh, I've had enough drama with a huge one at home. Nicknamed him Stan, you know, Spider Stan. The ones you can see, I don't know about you, but they end up in the corner of the room. You can see them, but you can't reach them. And they're there for a few days. So you always know where they are. And then they're not. They suddenly disappear. So that is the current situation. So I hope you're well wherever you're tuning in from. We've had one of those weeks. In fact, talking about oldest sheep, Charlie, our old boy of 12 and a half, he looks like maybe he's slowing down, bless him. Things shutting down, so I don't think it'll be long. But I've lined up a good home for Teddy, his best buddy, for when the time comes. I've decided I'm not going to keep sheep anymore. That'll be it. Also, the car broke down, so we were without that for a few days. And we need a new roof on the cottage. So there we are. Happy Christmas. Speaking of which, this week and next, Chef Mark Harris, who was a guest on the podcast last Friday, has kindly recorded a few hints and tips re-festive food for us. Next time is stuffing and roast potatoes, but for now...
Yorkshire puddings, I have a really basic recipe for. It's equal quantities of all three. So if you get a measuring jug, I'm trying to think, most people will have a tray of 12 Yorkshire puddings. Say a good mug of flour, a good mug of egg, and a good mug of milk. Whisk it up, doesn't matter if you've got lumps. Then put your oil into your trays. Again, oven 200 degrees. Put that tray in the oven for about 45 minutes or so. Really smoking hot. I pre-mix my Yorkies again. Give that a good rest, probably an hour and a half or so before you cook them. And then just drop them in to just below, probably 3/4 full. And then just watch them go mental and they will be massive, as big as your head Yorkshire puddings.
The tricks of the trade from Chef Mark Harris from the Pheasant at Neaton and the Tally Ho at Bolden, both in Shropshire. I checked with him and the mug is the size of your coffee mug, say, and the eggs, you just keep breaking them in until the mug is full. I bought myself a lovely old recipe book called The Yorkshire Way, compiled by the ladies of the WI. Not sure of the year, but suspect the 1950s, and have a look, and they have a savoury one in it, where you add boiled onions and dried sage to your Yorkshire pudding mix right at the last minute before baking them. We might have a go at that. Now, Christmas plants. I had some friends kind of give us a lovely pot of cyclamens when they visited a couple of weeks ago, and we're seeing them again very soon, so the pressure's on to make sure said plant's still going strong. So if you're in the same boat or you're thinking of buying perhaps a poinsettia for yourself or a family member, keep listening as we have the gardening guru Reg Moule for support and advice, starting with what is currently on our windowsill.
Cyclamen like it to be cool. That's the thing. So you don't really want them in the lounge with you particularly, but they'll enjoy being somewhere cooler, perhaps if it might be cooler in your kitchen. And when you're cooking, of course, you get high humidity levels, so the plants quite enjoy that. Or in your hall, they would quite like being in the hall, somewhere like that, or in a cooler room, rather than in the heat with you. And of course, cyclamen need to be watered from the bottom, rather than try to water them by splashing the water in amongst the leaves, because of course you get quite a tight mound of heart-shaped leaves with cyclamen, don't you? And then poking up out of the centre, you get the flowering stems coming up. And so the best way to water them is with all the plants, tepid water is best, rather than really cold water, you know, because we don't fancy having a bucket of cold water thrown over us, and neither do the plants. So if you can get tepid water, and then you either put that in a bowl or in a sink, stand your cyclamen in there, leave it in there for about 10, 15 minutes, by which time the surface of the compost should look a little bit sparkly. And then you put it on the draining board to let the surplus water drain away. And then you can put it back where it was. Now, hopefully, with all your Christmas or all your pot plants, really, where they're going back to is on a wide saucer of moist gravel. Because inside our homes, the central heating is so, the air is so dry, it's like they were in the middle of the Sahara Desert as far as they're concerned. So we need to put some humidity back around the foliage. And we do that by having a nice wide saucer, not a saucer that just fits the bottom of the pot, but wider than that, with gravel in it that you keep moist so that moist air can rise up around the foliage, and whatever plant it is, really, that's what they like. And even if you're not buying a plant for Christmas, but you've got some house plants at home, as long as they're not those thick-leaved succulent ones that can take care of themselves, if they're like a foliage plant or something, then put it onto a nice wide saucer of moist gravel to get that humidity. Okay. And then with cyclamen, of course, the flowers die off, don't they? So you have to take the dead flowers off. And the best way to do that is to get hold of the stem of the faded bloom, follow it down, get it between your finger and thumb, follow it right down into that mound of foliage. And then when you're near the little tuber that's in the middle of the foliage, just grip the stem lightly, twist it and pull, and then away the stem will come. And if you keep doing that, it will keep the plant producing more flowers for you. Give it a bit of plant food about once every 10 days or so.
Okay. Can I do a little sound effect when I do the pinching out, Reg?
Well, yes, you
So
yes, you can always do that.
So the next time a friend comes, how long will that cyclamen, hopefully, live for?
Ooh, live for
yes.
several years. I mean, they're not just a one-off thing.
Oh, no.
At all. Some people they are. And of course, I mean, on the continent, you know, people think about houseplants differently to us. They have them, they look good and flower, and then they chuck them out and buy another. But of course, in Britain, we think that we've got the plant and it's up to us to keep it alive and, you know, leave it to our grandchildren and our will and things like that. So we keep them growing, whereas a lot of people would just simply discard it. But no, you keep it going. Once we get to the, once it finishes flowering, that could be in February time, something
right.
like that.
Okay.
Just keep going if you look after them.
Right.
When they finish flowering, give them a little bit of a rest where you don't water them quite so often. And then when we get into about the end of April, May, you can put them outside in a shady place in the garden for the summer. Put them into a bigger pot when you take them out as well, because I expect the pot they're in will be too small by then.
Mm-hmm.
And then you bring them back in again about middle of October nowadays, because autumns are much warmer now than ever they used to be. So they can stay out longer. In most of the, you know, if you look in gardening books for information, most of them will say bring them in September. And of course, we'd used to have to do that. But now October is really the same sort of conditions that we used to have in September.
Does that go for the traditional Christmas one, the point poinsettia, which I guess could live and live, but then it doesn't stay red leaves, does it? Am I right? It loses its leaves.
You're quite right, Katie. Now, when I used to work with you years ago,
years ago,
and we used to talk about putting cardboard boxes over them in the middle of September to make them go red.
Yes.
Right? Now, that's what we used to have to do. But nowadays, the modern varieties have been bred to be much more reasonable, and they will go red, left to their own devices. Not until just after Christmas, but they will do it without any aid from us. The modern varieties will. But other than that, poinsettias have come down a lot in price to what they used to be years ago. So really, most people, I think, don't keep them from one year to another anymore. But certainly it is possible. If you want to keep one for the following year, about the end of February, you cut them right down as if you were pruning a rose, just to around about two or three buds long, and cut to an outward facing bud.
Yeah.
On the bottom of the plant. So you get something that looks like a pruned rose bush when you finish. And then you keep them dry for about 3 or 4 weeks. Then you can pop them into a larger pot and start to give them some water, and off they will go. But they will tend to be taller than they were this year by the time you
Interesting.
But first of all, we've got to keep the thing alive, haven't we? And if you're going to buy a poinsettia, what the first thing to remember is you don't buy one where they're stood outside.
Right.
And you don't buy one where they're displayed next to an electric door that opens and closes and brings loads of cold air in, because, they're a bit of prima donna-like, because they don't want to get chilled at all. They very quickly resent that. So you need to keep them warm. So buy them from somewhere where they're inside and kept warm.
Okay.
And if they aren't wrapped, make sure that they get wrapped for you to take home. Because if you're walking across a car park and there's a chilly wind, it can affect them. And ones that you buy that have been stood outside, they're dying before you get them home.
Oh, what a shame.
Because they've been chilled. But there you go.
Who puts them outside, though, Reg? That's ridiculous.
Oh, DIY shops, some supermarkets do.
Yeah.
People who don't know anything about plants but still attempt to sell them. Much to my chagrin. There you go. Once you get your plant home, where are you going to put it? And you put it in the warmest room you've got. They want at least, as I said, 60 degrees, which is about 16 centigrade, isn't it? That is the least they want.
Wow.
Anything better than that, they're happy with. So they'll be in the lounge with you. As with any house plant, of course, don't leave them on a windowsill at night and close the curtains on them, because it gets cold between the glass and the curtain. So if they're on a windowsill, bring them in from there. They do like, with all the houseplants, really, they'd like as much light as they can get, really, at this time of year, because there's no bright, really, scorching bright sun to damage them.
Mm.
And as before, a nice wide saucer of moist gravel to help to keep humid air coming up around the leaves. And with the poinsettias as well, this tepid water idea is definitely got to be done.
Yes.
If you put freezing cold water on them, then that chills their roots and the leaves just flop down and they look very unhappy.
Mm.
So do that. Now, with watering the poinsettias, they don't need loads and loads of water. With their cyclamen, we stood them in water and let them suck a lot of water up. Now, that's a very thorough watering method, and it only needs to be done about once every week or so, and with the poinsettias, they're much better off watered from the top and kept on the drier side.
With poinsettias, I've always gone from below, so that's interesting.
Well, you can do them from below,
but
it's better, I think, if you do them from the top, so that the so they, the water doesn't hang around them, and so that it drains through. Oh. These days, of course, we've also got the added excitement of peat-free composts now, and these are, but a lot of the ones used commercially have got coir in them, and of course coir is very good at looking dry on the top, but underneath it is moist. So it's worth getting a stick, one of those green, you know, plant sticks, something like that. You get split canes, push that into the compost, you know, right into the middle, and pull it out again, and then have a look at the stick and see if it's moist, and maybe there's little bits of compost, you know, stuck on it, in which case it's wet enough. But if it comes out completely dry and clean, then perhaps it wants some water. But just looking at the surface of these modern peat-free composts doesn't give you an idea of how moist the plants are all the way through.
Fabulous. Thank you ever so much, Reg. Are we allowed are we allowed to ask what you're up to at Christmas?
Me? I shall be at home. Because of course I've got I've got to look after the dog. And if I go off to my children in rugby, then I've got to take the dog. And he's 13 and a half. He's a chocolate lab. Oh. And he doesn't travel well. So I shall just stay at home, and I shall get some sirloin and cook myself some sirloin for my Christmas dinner. And I shall be very happy. Lots of other, it's everyone else who keeps saying to me, you can't be on your own on Christmas Day. Yes, I can. And I'm quite happy in that position.
Yes. Well, you have to deal with people all the time, don't you?
Yeah. So that's what I shall be doing here with the dog and my rescue parrot.
Rescue parrot?
I got a rescue parrot. There's a charity called Safe Haven Parrot Refuge.
Right.
That I first came across when I used, years ago, I used to work in Tewkesbury for, I don't know, loads of years, 28, 29 years at the Garden Centre there, nursery. And I'd heard of them then because they were based in Twynning, just near Tewkesbury.
Yeah.
But of course, since then, the people who used to run it then have got, more elderly, and it's become a national charity.
Ah.
And lots of people have parrots, and members of the parrot family, and of course they're all long-lived things, and they don't realize how much care they need. You can't sort of abandon them and go off to work for long periods and leave them on their own, because they get fed up, because they're flock birds, and you're their flock.
Aww.
So you end up with them getting behavioural difficulties, and then people don't want to keep them anymore, and so they take them on, and then people can contact them and become foster parents, which is what I am. And I originally thought I'd have a cockatiel because I'd had them before, and when the lady came to check me for it, check the house, that was all, check over the house, it's all right, things like that. And she said, what sort of a bird were you thinking of having? And I said, well, a cockatiel perhaps. And she said, well, you can. She said, we've got two cockatiels, but we have got a Quaker parrot, a female Quaker parrot, who needs to be with a man and in a quiet house,
Is that where she came from originally then, Reg? That's what she...
I don't know where she came from originally. They don't tell you that. She was found, though. They did tell me that. She escaped.
Right.
And she was caught in a garden in Derby.
Oh.
I had to go to Derby to get her. Because one of their people, for that person, for that area, is where she was.
Got you.
So I went up and collected. I thought about it for a bit, and looked up about Quaker parrots. And of course, they can be difficult. As can any of them. In the end, I thought, well, I'll give her a chance because she just needs a home. And they said that they couldn't. There weren't many like men in my position, where they were on their own. Having a, who wanted to have a parrot. So anyway, I had her, and that was over a year ago. I won't say she was easy from the beginning, because she wasn't. She'd used to savage me when she got the chance.
No.
Oh, yeah. She'd take bits out of my ear and things. So she'd sit on you. She'd come and be all friendly, and then suddenly, ow.
Oh.
Get a chunk out your ear. Anyway, she's got a lot better lately. I've had her over a year now, and she's right. I haven't been attacked for a few months.
Oh, that's good.
And of course, she talked when she came.
Oh, and lovely. She's learned
a few other things since she's been here. You know, she can she laughs like me.
Oh.
And I had a cough a while ago, and she now coughs as well. And she's learned to say a few more things since she's been with me, like "What's the matter?" She'll say that. And recently, I was sat in the room watching the telly, and she was in the next room, and I heard this whining, just like the dog, Woody, you know, their chocolate lab. He's worried by the little bits of wooden floor between the mats sometimes, because he can slip, yeah. And he'll just look at it, and pluck up the courage. And while he's doing that, he goes, and then suddenly he goes across, and she was doing that.
Oh, how funny. Oh, and she, wow.
She now whines like the dog.
Oh. What's her name, Reg?
Her name is Fiona.
Was she called Fiona?
Well, I don't think so. But they gave her that name because she's grey and green like Fiona in Shrek.
Oh, she sounds lovely. We need a picture. Send a picture over for me, and we'll put it on our Instagram and Facebook pages. Oh, lovely. Well, happy Christmas, Reg, when it comes to it.
Yes.
Fiona and Woody.
Thank you very much.
And,
and same to you.
Oh, the lovely Reg Moole, gardening guru, and Fiona is one lucky lady. Reg has sent me a couple of pictures of her, so I'll pop those on Chat Bagley's Facebook and Instagram pages, along with Woody, the chocolate lab. We can't miss him out. An update on the cyclamen. Have to say, it's looking fantastic since having Reg's advice, so our friends can now visit again. Right then, question for you. Are you a fan of the audiobook? I certainly am. And if, like me, you may have even wondered what it takes to narrate one. Well, let's meet an award-winning narrator, actor and singer who joined me from her kitchen in the Upper West Side of Manhattan, Barry Krynick. And yes, I did check the pronunciation of it first, just in case.
I get all sorts of alternatives depending on how people think it looks, such as Crank and Kresnick and Krynick and all sorts. So, yeah, but yes, it is Krynick.
I've never had that position with my surname, be it this one or Smith, that anybody has ever got it wrong. So,
Did you go from Smith to Johnson?
No,
that's pretty easy transition.
Yeah, and very, very common as well. At least with yours, it's very nice. And I know it's a strange question, but because you're an actress, is that your real name or is that a stage name?
That is my real name. I don't know that I would have chosen that as a stage name. I did think very briefly when I was at university about changing my name. My middle name is Judith. And I thought maybe I should become Judith Barry. That sounds like that could be a good stage name. You know, I was like 18 and I thought, well, that would be. Then I thought, well, but I would still answer to Barry because that's what everyone calls me. And I don't know if I feel like a Judith. And then what about giving up my, and I thought it's not worth it. Forget it. So people will learn how to pronounce it or they won't, but you know.
Has it always,
Krynick, I mean.
Is it something you've always wanted to do, acting? Is that red wine?
Oh, no, it's water. It is water. It's 10 a.m., Katie. I haven't started quite that early.
I do apologize, but as you lift it up and, of course, the backdrop of your top, I thought, but then I've forgotten. Oh. Yes, of course, it is 10 o'clock.
Looks
your
quite
end.
Dark. Yes. Yeah, it's 5 o'clock somewhere, but not here.
So was the acting always something you wanted to do then, Barry?
Yes. Yes, it was. I decided I wanted to be a professional actor when I was 8.
Yes.
I had seen a couple of Broadway shows at that point, and the one that we saw that year, I grew up in Connecticut, which is about 2 hours north of here, and so we used to come into the city. My dad was from New York. We always came into the city at Christmas time, and we would see Broadway shows, and I just, after a couple of those, said that's the thing that I want to do. But I discovered as an adult, I dug up some old school documents and my kindergarten report card said, Barry is most comfortable in the make-believe corner. So it seems like it was something that was sort of destined.
Oh, I love that. All my reports ever said that I used to just talk too much. And if I...
I did that too, definitely.
If I applied as much, time and interest into studying as I do chatting, and yes, I'd be all right. Well, there we are.
Yep.
Oh, how wonderful. So to achieve the goal that you always wanted, was mum and dad involved in the stage at all then, Barry? Any parents? Grandparents?
No, not at all. My dad was an engineer and my mom started out as a teacher, and then she worked in advertising and PR, but they were theater lovers.
Yeah.
They both they loved theater. I grew up listening to show tunes and being taken to the theater. Mm. And I was very lucky because they both felt that they needed to let their only child do whatever she wanted to do with her life. Mm. So they were very supportive, which was nice.
I was like you. I think I was even earlier than 8. I wanted to be an actress. That's what I wanted
to do. Oh, wow.
So I did speech and drama all throughout till I was 13, 14, did all the festivals, did all that. This is what I was going to do. And then I sadly got alopecia when I was a teenager. And I just wanted to hide away. So I ended up thinking, what can I do? Oh, I shall go and work on a farm in the middle of nowhere so no one can see me. And that's how then I ended up doing that. But now I do envy you that, Barry, because that's what I always wanted to do.
But weren't you on the radio for a while?
I was. That was the scenic route. I did dairy farming for about 15 years.
Wow, okay.
Yeah, and then I moved from there to the radio. But yeah, I went the scenic route. So I was always wanted to go on the stage. So
that's amazing. Yeah. Wow.
So are you in anything at the moment?
I am not. The main thing that I do as a performer nowadays is audiobook narration.
I saw that. And you won a winner as well. You won an ear something. What was it, an ear?
I've won several earphones awards. Those are given out by Audiophile Magazine, which is the sort of trade publication. Every month they give out earphones awards to sort of the best audiobooks of the month. So I have several of those. And then the Audi Awards are sort of the Oscars of the audiobook industry. And I've been nominated a few times and I won one of those. So.
Fabulous.
Must be fun. Yeah, it's lovely to get recognized.
Do you do it in your own home? Have you a studio or do you have to go somewhere to do that?
I go into professional recording studios. I do have a little setup, this microphone that I'm using right now. I will sit in my closet to record auditions or very, very short projects. But you really have to be in a soundproof space. And in the middle of Manhattan, it is difficult to make any part of an apartment soundproof. I have friends who have managed to do it. I have not. So I go into professional recording studios for that. Yeah.
Now, I have listened to a few audiobooks and they're quite long. So do you go in and do it there and then? I mean, it could be 3.5 to 6 hours, couldn't it? Or do you do it in stages?
Well, you do it in stages. What they tend to do is they budget 2 studio hours per finished hour. So if a book is going to be about 10 hours long, they give you 20 hours in the studio. I typically do 6 hours a day. So I'm there from 10 a.m. to 4 p.m. with breaks. I take 5-10 minutes every hour, and then I take a lunch break. So I'm talking maybe 4.5 to 5 hours in a day. Mm. And then it'll take me, 3 or 4 days to do a full length book or more, depending on the length, like you say.
And do you like to read that book beforehand or do you just sight reading and do it there and then?
Oh, if it's, I'm a good cold reader. I can sit down and sort of read whatever's put in front of me. I've done educational audiobooks for a long time and that's pretty much how those go, but that's really short form stuff. When it's a full length book, especially if it's a novel, I always read it in advance and I score the script. So I highlight the different characters' dialogue in different colors so that I know at a glance who's speaking. Right. And my specialty within the audiobook world is accents and dialects. So I'm often switching back and forth between lots of different accents as well. So I always need to know in advance how I'm going to have to perform all those characters.
Bet it's exciting. Do you enjoy
it? It's very exciting. Very much. I love to act and I love to read. And it's like the perfect combination of those two things.
Mm. Do you do any... bios. So is it all
biographies?
Fiction. Is it fiction? Yes. Or do you do any non-fiction?
I do mostly fiction, again, because I have that sort of accent/character voice specialty, but I do non-fiction as well. I'm going to start 2024 narrating quite a long biography, actually. So that will be interesting. But yeah, I've done memoirs and things too.
Oh, I bet that's wonderful too. The one you're going to do, is this the one that you've been teasing what you're going to be doing
that,
next
the
year?
The one I've been teasing is something that I have written. So I'm a writer as well. Ooh. I write plays and I write creative nonfiction. And I have written a play called The Queen of 14th Street, which is going to be produced as an audio drama. So like an audiobook or like a radio play,
yes,
really. And that is being produced by Hachette Audio. Hachette is one of the big five publishers here in the US.
Wow.
And it's going to be released on June 4th, 2024. I'm going to be performing in it with four other actors. Mm-hmm. And it has just become available for pre-order.
Oh, wow.
So, yes. Yeah, so by the time this podcast airs, I will have announced that on my social media and all that stuff. So it's, that is extremely exciting. I started writing the play 7 years ago.
7 years.
And I developed it for the theater. It had some momentum at the beginning of 2020. We were doing a staged reading of it. You, in the process of developing a play, you often will do readings where the actors are all on book, but you're presenting it, you know, for a small invited audience usually. And I had some momentum going with a theater company that was interested in it. And then the pandemic just shuttered everything. Mm. So I put it on a shelf for a couple of years. And then a friend of mine who is an audiobook producer had seen that reading and was really interested in producing it on audio. And audio originals, as they're called, are an expanding part of the industry. So not just a book that's been written in print that's then produced on audio, but pieces that are actually written to be performed on audio. It's been a long process because publishing is a very slow business, but we're finally doing it. So it's really exciting.
So what is it, or who is it about?
You know what? I'm going to read you the synopsis I wrote that's on the publisher's page. It is much more succinct than anything I could say extemporaneously to explain it. So here we go. New York City, 1932. Eva LeGallien is trying to save her theater company from the jaws of the Depression by mounting an innovative new production of Alice in Wonderland. She agrees to give a radio interview for the sake of publicity, but while revisiting the moments that shaped her career, she struggles with the need to keep a significant secret. She and her leading lady are in love. As Eva's work careens toward catastrophe, she fights to preserve her dream of a people's theater, but will she destroy the people she loves in the process? The true story of one of the 20th century's most remarkable artists, the Queen of 14th Street reverberates powerfully today as the American theater faces an uncertain future and LGBT rights are once again under attack.
Mm.
It's historical fiction about a real person, basically.
She was one heck of a woman, wasn't she?
She was.
Because she was born in London?
She was born in London in 1899. Mm. She became a star on the West End at 16. She had grown up in Paris with her Danish mother, moved back to London, became a West End star, decided to make her way to New York, became a Broadway star at 21, and at age 27 in 1926, gave all of that up to found New York's first classical repertory company, the Civic Repertory Theater, which she ran pretty much single-handedly, directing, acting and producing for 7 years.
Yeah,
that's the time period that the play covers. She went on to live to the age of 92, mm-hmm. doing all sorts of acting, directing, producing, etc. But the play is principally about that sort of first period of her life.
Oh, sounds fantastic. Oh, well done.
Yes. And thank you. And I will be playing the character of Eva in the play. So
well, of course.
Very exciting.
Of course. You couldn't write it and give it to anybody else.
No, of course not.
Did she, because she was born in London, how old was she when she moved? Did she have an English accent or an American accent or a French accent?
She could speak fluent French and was so sort of blasé about it. She said, well, you know, French was my first language, so of course I speak French just the way I speak English. I've listened to a number of recordings of her, and her accent is identifiably British, but sort of softened. And of course, at that time, American accents often tended to sound more like what we would associate British accents with today, sort of the dropping ahs and things like that. Yeah. Yes, it was a sort of a hybrid British-American accent.
You obviously love doing your accents, which is...
I do love doing my accents.
You just drop into it.
Have
you ever thought about doing impressions? Because to do an accent, you've got to have that certain brain to mouth. Mm-hmm. I would love it, but mine don't connect. But yours must do. Do you do that? It kind of is the natural next thing, isn't it?
I don't really. Other people have asked me that as well. And I don't, I suppose I've just never really focused on imitating particular people other than Eva LeGallien, because I'm going to be playing her, or anyone else where I'm trying to do somebody's specific voice. But I'm not impressions, but I do all sorts of different characterizations, accents, you know, kind of making things up.
Yeah. So there you are in New York, slap bang in the middle, within the kitchen. Kind of noticed you went mad a couple of weekends ago because your pages were full of bakes.
Yes.
And I'm guessing all in that little kitchen behind you.
All in this little kitchen, that's correct. Yes, I have a small but devoted following for my baking stories on Instagram, so I do those occasionally. Yeah. I had some friends over for a little sort of informal holiday do, which was basically an excuse for me to get to bake some stuff. So I made a pumpkin bundt cake with maple brown butter glaze.
Ooh.
I think I might have to put maple brown butter glaze on everything from now on. It's really, really good. I made a flourless chocolate cake with a chocolate ganache topping, and I made peanut butter berry bars.
Oh, well, I tell you, your friends are lucky. So is it something that you enjoy doing?
I love baking. I learned how to bake as a kid. I used to bake with my mom. And then I started watching The Great British Bake Off, I guess, in about 2017. And that really inspired me to get back into baking and to try baking things I hadn't made before. Mm. So the reason I started listening to Shaq Baggerly is because I had taken a baking class with Howard Middleton through Bake with a Legend. Yeah, and I also listened to the Bakedown podcast. So I was following him on Instagram and I thought, what is this other podcast that he's doing? This sounds interesting. And then started listening to the two of you, and I love your accents, actually, both of you, and yeah, I really enjoyed that.
I was going to say Yorkshire accent because you do that. I know you do a Yorkshire accent, but
Yorkshire's my favourite accent. I love it. I love it so much. We just don't have anything like it here. So,
so do you know anybody? I mean, how do you do that? Do you watch things? Is it instant? Do you have to work on it? Because that's very good.
Thank you. I always get a bit nervous doing British accents with real British people, but I can't seem to help myself. I work on it by listening to it. So there are systems of sound changes that one learns when one. I also work as a dialect coach, teaching other people how to do accents. And I started studying accent work when I was at university, and learned how to take your native accent, the accent you're speaking in, and which sound changes you have to make to do any number of other ones. So when I'm learning a new one, I listen to native speakers, and I try to identify what those sound changes are. For example, with Yorkshire, the A sound, which in American English is a diphthong, A is A, it's that long A.
Aye.
like Kete. And the O sound, which also is a diphthong in American English, is O. The A and the O are very sort of Yorkshire characteristic. And then what really fascinates me is, so an accent is how you pronounce words. A dialect is what you say in addition to how you say it. So that the words and phrases that one uses, how those change from one region to another. And what really interests me about England is there are so many different ways of speaking in such a tiny country. And you can go 10 miles and hear a different accent, and people are using different words for different things. And more broadly, of course, there are differences between American English and British English, sort of generally speaking. But when I was in graduate school, I got an MFA in acting. I got a summer travel grant from my university. I said, I want to go to England and study accents, which basically was just traveling around talking to people about how they talk.
Yeah.
And I was in Warwick, and the proprietor of the B&B I was staying at why I was traveling. And he said, you have to talk to my wife. She's from the Black Country. Oh. And I said, the what? I had never heard that name for a region. And I sat down with her, and she very clearly explained to me the difference between a Brummy accent and a Black Country accent.
Oh, yes.
And Birmingham and Wolverhampton are, what, 20 miles apart, maybe?
If that.
But she was really clear about those two groups of people have different ways of talking. It was fascinating.
Yeah, Black Country is its own language. I have a few friends from the Black Country. They are very very protective of their language, and so they should be. But it is very much the Black Country, and there it is. Interesting, because you mentioned Wolverhampton, because that's the one thing I probably can do, but only the name of it. So it's Wolverhampton, all right, because that's the only thing I can do. But yes. It's fascinating. And you went to Scotland and you worked there for a while as well, I believe.
No, I wish. No, I was in a play here in New York that took place in Scotland. So I went to Scotland in my mind. I have been to Scotland, but not recently. When I was learning the Yorkshire accent and listening to videos on YouTube, now that we have YouTube and everybody's recording themselves, it's very easy to find different accents. And there was this recording of a little girl who's probably 20 now, because I think it was made like 15 years ago. And it says, you know, perfect Yorkshire accent. And you hear somebody in the background say, "What do you like most about Daddy?" And she says, "Oh, Daddy, like, you know, when he was taller like that, he didn't juggle anymore. He just lay down on bed and put one arm up like a monkey." That's it. If I can learn how to do that, I will have mastered this accent.
That's wonderful. Now then, sharing a few things on Chat Bagley, when we chat to different people, we often say, "Do you have a favourite recipe?" And I know it must be such a hard one for you, but you have come up with one. Is this something that you had to think about, like the accents, or is it straight away, "That is my favourite recipe"?
Well, I don't know about favourite, but when you asked for a recipe, I thought, well, I've just created one from scratch for the first time. So I figured I would share that. And it is a favorite of mine at the moment. So I visited Northern Ireland with my mom back in June. We went on vacation there.
Which
part? We have a family friend sort of all over. So we have a family friend who grew up in Northern Ireland. She moved to the States when she was a child, but she regularly goes back to visit her family. And she kept talking to us about it and all, "You should go, you should go." So we decided to go, and she recommended different places. So we flew into Dublin, we drove up to Belfast. We stayed in Belfast for 4 days. And while we were there, we did a little day trip to the Ards Peninsula, all these little seaside towns, so beautiful. And then we drove from Belfast all the way up to the northernmost part of the country along the Antrim Coast Road.
Yep.
So we went to Giant's Causeway, and then down the other side back into the Republic of Ireland to County Donegal, and we stayed in a seaside town called Rosnaula, which was just stunning. Yeah. And the hotel we were at was right on the beach. Neither of us wanted to leave. It was just so beautiful. And everywhere we went in Northern Ireland, all the restaurants, all the hotel breakfasts, everything served what they called wheaten bread. And I figured out after tasting a few that it must be a soda bread, but we don't have anything called wheaten bread here. I thought, it's not whole wheat bread. It's okay. And each one was slightly different. And I remember one place in particular, my mom and I each bit into our slices and looked at each other and said, "Oh, this one has molasses in it." Oh. That's really good. And when I came back, I thought, I'd really like to learn how to make that.
Yeah.
I'm not a major bread baker because of all the proving. It just takes so long. I have made ordinary wheat bread, but I thought with soda bread, I could do that. So I started looking up recipes, and I didn't find very many. But I tried as many as I could find, about 4 or 5, and none of them tasted quite like what I remembered from Northern Ireland. So I thought, I'm going to try to make my own and see if this works. So after much trial and error and attempting things, and particularly adjusting baking times, because I thought I had it, and then, you know, cut the first couple slices and said, "This is great," and got into the middle and said, "This is raw." not so good. I developed this recipe for what I call Irish American wheaten bread.
That's fabulous. So not just acting, singing, audio books, etc., but you're now doing, you've created your own.
I have created a recipe. Yes. I'm now baking. I mean, I love to bake. I think most of my bakes would probably be described as rustic.
I like rustic.
Perhaps even rough and ready, I think, is what Perlith tends to say. I don't have visual arts skills. So I don't do fancy decorations and all that. I always watch the Bake Off and think, I wish I could do that, but I can't. But they do taste good. And that's really what matters. So this bread, if people are interested, I would love to hear if you post it and people try it, what happens, whether it only works for me or if fit it to work too. Now, can I ask you, when I sent you the recipe, I then looked at it and thought, I don't know if these first two ingredients are that easy to find in the UK, buttermilk and molasses.
Buttermilk,
I heard recently that buttermilk is not easy. You can, okay.
You can, yeah, buttermilk. And molasses, I guess you would probably perhaps substitute for a black treacle or something. But no,
black treacle, I wondered that.
But okay. That's fine. Molasses, we know what molasses is, so you can do that.
Okay.
And you're right, it is a soda. It's sort of a wholemeal soda bread, isn't it, I think, mm-hmm. that we would have.
Yes.
And you've kindly let us have that recipe, which we're going to have on its own on our Facebook and Instagram pages as an audio.
Okay.
Because that's what you do. So there you go. So thank you ever so much for that, Barry. And yes, and we shall also put it on our Instagram and Facebook pages. So when we eat into our wheaten bread or our wholemeal soda bread, we've got to conjure up thoughts of Ireland. What did you think of Southern Ireland? Southern Ireland is beautiful.
Southern Ireland is beautiful. The whole island is beautiful. Yeah. I mean, the coastline, especially wherever you are, is just stunning. Yeah. Absolutely.
And people are so friendly. And they,
I
managed to go over there with a pal, years ago. And we've invited in folks' homes. And it's just magical. Absolutely magical. Oh, I'm glad you got to experience it.
I was in Dublin in 2017. And then when I was 17 years old, took a holiday to the west coast of Ireland with my parents. So I've been to a couple of other places in the Republic of Ireland. It's gorgeous. I think I must have lived several past lifetimes in Britain and Ireland because I have I have lifelong family friends from England. So England and English people have always been in my life because my mom actually she was an exchange student in Doncaster in Yorkshire when she was at university.
Yeah.
But I feel so at home there in Britain and Ireland. It's something slightly otherworldly for me. So the connection is very strong. And obviously I watch a lot of British TV and films and all that, which is another way the accents sort of filter in to my brain.
Yeah. Well, look, it's been an absolute joy to meet you. Thank you ever so much.
Likewise. Thank you so much, Katie. I'm honored.
We wish you well with
your
next project, which is going to be June, but you can pre-order it now.
Pretty much wherever you get your audiobooks. And I am told it is being released worldwide, so you can get it in the UK as well.
Well, good job I chatted to you now, because, you know, in a few months, that could be it. You'd be off. And
I doubt it, but who knows?
Katie who, knows? We'll you'd see. Say. Katie who. The hugely talented Barry Krynick, and wishing her well with the Queen of 14th Street, out on June the 4th next year, but available to pre-order now. Barry's wheaten bread recipe I will pop onto Shat Bagley's Facebook and Instagram pages, both audio and written, and Barry has kindly sent a picture of it as well. Next week, I'm hoping to share with you a story that could quite easily be a Christmas movie. Chef Mark will offer up his roast potatoes and stuffing tips and hints. Oh yes, and it's time for the Shat Bagley Christmas song. So I hope you can join me then. As always, you can get in touch via Facebook and Instagram, and also email podcast@theshatbagley.co.uk. And don't forget to follow or subscribe to the podcast. It's totally free, and I always promise, absolutely no funny business. So that's it for another week. Thank you for listening, and see you next time. And a clue for the tune next week. An Andy Williams classic. Yep, I'll apologise now.